All right. Lots of technical stuff. We had the Zoom camera, a different camera for the Vesak altar, so. All right. So I will begin by greeting the people on Zoom, and then the people in the Zendo can introduce themselves. So I'll start with Betty.
Betty.
Dave.
Dave.
Paulette.
Paulette.
Mark.
Mark.
Mary.
Mary.
Rosemary.
Rosemary.
Brian.
Brian.
Pat.
Pat.
Lisa.
Lisa.
Jim.
Jim.
Bob.
Bob.
And Sabrina.
Sabrina.
And in the Zendo.
Dave.
Dave.
Dennis.
Dennis.
Shoketsu.
Shoketsu.
Kazu.
Kazu. Kazu.
Doryu.
Doryu.
Alex.
Alex.
Yeshe
Tsoki. Yeshe
Tsoki. Jinryu.
Jinryu.
Linda.
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 Don't we? All right. Thank you all for being here. Last Sunday, I was in West Virginia at a nonviolent civil disobedience climate action. And if you are curious about how that went, I posted a podcast episode about it on my Climate and You podcast. So if you're at all curious about that, if you are signed up to our email newsletter, that now has a link to my Climate and You podcast. So if you're, you can listen to it or you can read it. I guess I was thinking of something else I was supposed to mention, but basically, if you go to our website, we now have a neat, like, this week at Brightway Zen page. And, you know, there's all kinds of stuff going on. Now, there is a Monday grief support group. And then we have Tuesday evening class. Thursdays, there is a podcast discussion group, which currently is studying the precepts along with the Tuesday group. Saturday mornings, we have sitting and Sangha check-in online. And then, of course, we have Sundays. So check all that stuff out for things you owe at a monthly book group as well. And recently, we also started a death and dying group, which, you know, they've just started to meet. I'm not sure what they're going to call themselves, but that will be exploring some of our lineage-specific practices around death and dying in support of that, but also the more practical, and also to try to prepare to respond to and support Sangha members as they're actually facing death and dying in their lives.
Who's leading that?
I don't know that anybody's leading it in particular.
It's a group.
Yeah.
It's the group.
So I think
self-led right now.
All right, anything else I should mention or any questions about any of that? All right. So today is another Dharma talk that is coming out of my recently did a Q&A session and people submitted questions. And I didn't get to all of them that day. And so one of them, I was actually from Katie, and she's not here today, so we'll have to tell her to go ahead and listen to this. She was curious about our lineage and to know more about some of the specific characters in our lineage. And actually, that reminds me, Dennis, would you mind passing chant books out to people? And any of you at home who have one, or they can also be accessed on our website. We will be talking about the lineage of Dharma ancestors, which can be found on page 7. So one of the things Katie pointed out was that a lot of times Westerners tend to just ignore history. And we also need to consider, I'm not going to go into that today, but we need to consider the question of cultural appropriation when here we are, the vast majority of us, white Western converts to a religion that comes to us through China and Japan. And so hopefully we don't just take it and ignore whatever came before and assume that we've got, you know, we understand it and we can just forget about where it comes from and our history. So volumes could be written on the history of Buddhism and on our lineage and on any one of these folks that I'm going to mention today. But I'm going to try to give you a whole picture of our 2,500 year history in this Dharma talk, which means, you know, it's only going to be a very basic broad brush impression. And I'm going to do it by focusing on the ancestors, which in this list that we chant during our morning service. So if we met every day as a Sangha, we'd probably chant this every morning, but we just chant it on Sunday mornings, unless, of course, we have a ceremony like Vesak. And this list of ancestors, every once in a while, you'll see a little triangle next to a name. And that's where the doan, the person with the instruments, goes, and that's called a quats. It's a percussion sound. That means, you know, something significant is happening. And you notice that there's, you know, a certain number of names that have those quatses next to them. And they're very significant people in our lineage. And, you know, when I'm up on the bowing mat as the celebrant, I will make a bow during those names. So I'm just going to be covering those names as a way to kind of give you a little bit of a sense of our lineage over a long period of time. So just a couple words before I begin, though, if you're not familiar about this whole idea of lineage. So Buddhism, and especially Zen, is a lineage tradition. And you might think of it, the most similar thing in Western culture is probably like apprenticeship traditions, where you learn a craft from someone, you study with them, and then they say, yeah, you know, you've got it. And then you can become, you know, you can become a journeyman, and then you become a master of the craft. So this is a very personal thing between teacher and student. And so this teacher gives what we call Dharma transmission to that student. Now you are empowered to pass the Dharma on and teach. And so it goes down through the generations, which means then that, you know, all of us share, like a family tree, we share Shakyamuni Buddha and quite a few Indian ancestors, but then it starts to branch off. And so, you know, we share Shakyamuni with Vajrayana Buddhism and Pure Land Buddhism, and we all share Shakyamuni, but then at some point it starts to branch off. And then, you know, it gets very specific. Like our specific Dharma cloud lineage is specifically from my teachers, Kyogen and Gyokoko Carlson, through Roshi Kenin. So, anyway, there's that sense of family tree, and I have a couple episodes on my Zen Studies podcast about Dharma transmission if you want to know more about that, episodes 51 and 52, how it looks and kind of what it means and what it doesn't mean and stuff like that. And then also I have episode 95 of my podcast is about lineage, specifically its function in carrying on a collective tradition, but also in how our personal practice relates to a lineage tradition. So just go to my podcast site and search for Lineage or Dharma Transmission or ask me about it if you want to know more. So I wanted to introduce also today, this is a book called The Denka Roku by Keizong Zenji. He's in our lineage, a couple people after Dogen, and we'll be talking a little bit about him today. And this is a traditional type of Zen book or Chan book, which, you know, tells here's a teacher and this is the interaction they had with their own teacher and how they kind of awakened, and tells each of their stories. So this goes all the way from Shakyamuni, there's a chapter for each ancestor, all the way through Khotun Echo. So that's a lot of people. That's the whole of our, you know, so page 7 and page 8 and partway down page 9. So there's a lot of ancestor stories in the Denka Roku. And the further back you go, the more mythical it becomes. I mean, and there's even the latest ancestor I'm going to be talking about today have an aspect of that. And this is kind of true of all familial and cultural lineages, you know, that there's the facts of what happened, but then there's also the stories that we tell about the facts, which in some ways are just as important. So a lot of these things, when you look back, the further back you go, the more clearly, okay, that's myth. But then as it comes through time, there are myths that we tell about Soto Zen and about Chan and all that, about, you know, in more recent centuries, that are still pretty, they're stories that we tell. But, you know, there it is. So I'll be sharing a little bit of the mythical and a little bit of the what we know historically as well. And just a note also, before I begin, is that you may note, if you have the chanting book, that there is another line of Dharma ancestors on page 19. This is a line of women Dharma ancestors. And I apologize that we have not been chanting them lately. When we were going to come meet back in person, we didn't want anybody to be sitting here yelling and leading a chant. So I recorded the chant, and I just recorded service A, and then I got busy and I never recorded service B, which is usually we alternate. So I'm hoping to get around to recording service B, and then I suppose we should just chant that for a couple months, to be fair. But, you know, to be truthful, this line of men is, that's the traditional line, and only on page 10, great teacher Houghton Jiu is a woman. So that's my Dharma grandmother. So it has been a very, very skewed and sexist tradition in Buddhism. And frequently this ability to be able to have students and transmit students and have them go on to transmit students was something that often didn't happen for the women. Even if they had the opportunity to practice, their practice places weren't supported in the same way. They weren't insulated from persecution in the same way. So it was much more difficult for them to have a real lineage tradition like the men did. So a lot of those names on the women's list aren't necessarily teacher-student relationships. Some of them are. But if you're curious about this, and I'll talk more about it at some point, this is Women of the Way by Sally Jiko Tisdale. And she, discovering 2,500 years of Buddhist wisdom, and in part, you know, because I know Jiko, she's a Dharma sister of mine. In part, she wrote this because the Denka Roku, traditionally in our lineage, we have a retreat called Denkoi every year, and we study one of the chapters from this book. So every year we'd have this retreat, and it would be centered on one of the ancestors, and it was very a very significant, important, sweet retreat. But, you know, after a while, you get a little tired of just studying men when you're a woman, right? To really have a sense that, you know, there were ancestors like me. Sometimes when I'm reciting this list of male ancestors, you know, the thought goes through my mind, like, probably the majority of these guys wouldn't even have taken me as a student. They wouldn't even have acknowledged my full, you know, capacity. So I actually get a little more touched when I recite the line of women ancestors, because all of them would have had a different attitude. So that's just a side note. So today I do have a list. If you are interested, there are obviously, there's lots of wonderful sources on the history of Buddhism and even specifically Zen. I kind of wish I was in the movie The Matrix, where you could just like put a plug in the back of your head and then you're be filled with like knowledge. Because these are books that I would definitely like, I'd plug into my head. Because there's a great one called How Zen Became Zen, The Dispute Over Enlightenment and the Formation of Chan Buddhism in Song Dynasty China. There's Soto Zen in Medieval Japan. There's The Other Side of Zen, A Social History of Soto Zen Buddhism in Tokugawa Japan. You know, a lot of times we think of the pure monastic practices as being those of the real practices, and then there were these cultural accretions. But we're really starting to question that as well, that, you know, these religions evolved and they were rich and they were in a cultural setting. They involved families, they involved ceremonies, they involved people's everyday lives. So there's a part of that that, you know, bordering on cultural appropriation, we've just quickly discarded. And we're starting to fortunately look back at some of that and go, maybe this is Buddhism and Zen too in a way. And then there's also an American encounter with Buddhism about when Buddhism started coming to the West. All right, so to get to our ancestors in this list, I am not going to talk about the first seven names on page seven, because they are the previous Buddhas and then ending with Shakyamuni Buddha. So I think we talk enough about Shakyamuni Buddha. I won't go into him today, but what's a fascinating teaching in and of itself is that we say there were Buddhas before this one person awakened. So it's like the way, the Buddha way, is something that maybe humankind will lose sometimes, but then somebody will awaken to it again. So it's not like here is a Buddha who delivered us, you know, through his specialness or agency. He discovered a path which had been discovered before and will be discovered again. So after Shakyamuni is a list of Indian ancestors. And each of these, we have a story in the Denkaroku, and a lot of these early ones are also mentioned in the Pali Canon, Ananda and Makakasho. Now the first marked ancestor is Nagarjuna, page 8, or Nagarjuna, an Indian ancestor. And he is significant to our lineage in a historical and mythical sense. It's always difficult to be 100% sure of these things, but he is believed to have lived around 150 CE and is the author of a text called the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. So this is a Nagarjuna's middle way. And this is where the Mahayana Buddhism is really starting to take shape. Just a couple hundred years after the Buddha, you know, there was a Mahayana developed as a sort of philosophy, and it was right in there with other practitioners of Buddhism. Just like, you know, we might practice side by side, and I kind of like the Mahayana philosophy, and maybe you don't. But it's really eventually started to take shape and create its own texts. And as this is happening, Mahayana needed to establish its legitimacy, because it's like, well, that's not what, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha said. because they had this orally transmitted tradition, which actually, you know, the process of oral transmission is actually very reliable. The scriptures are held communally, so it's not like one person can just go off and tweak a few things. It's held communally, so there was a sense of a real canon of works. And now there were these other teachings that people were emphasizing. So we would say, well, that, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha didn't say that. And actually these new Mahayana scriptures, they actually said, Shakyamuni Buddha said, right? In the sutras, they would say, and then Shakyamuni Buddha, blah, blah, blah. So there was this clash. So they developed this mythology that the Mahayana did, that people earlier on weren't ready for the Mahayana teachings. So the Buddha had given them, but then they had been kept safe below the sea by the Nagas, which are like serpent, dragon, supernatural kind of beings. And Nagarjuna is Naga excellence. So he was, according to the mythology, a very adept, he was adept at magic and all kinds of different things. And he got in well with the Nagas. And he was the one that brought the Mahayana Sutras up from the depths of the sea. And that's where they came from. So that's obviously the mythology part. And that he brought the Prajnaparamita or Wisdom Sutras to us. So that's the mythology part, but he did, write this text, which is a philosophical, very dense philosophical text that I have to be honest, I have not studied. But here's from the intro, the Mula Madhyamaka Karika by Nagarjuna is the foundational text of the Madhyamaka school of Indian Buddhist philosophy. It consists of verses constituting 27 chapters. In it, Nagarjuna seeks to establish the chief tenet of Madhyamaka, that all things are empty, shunya, or devoid of intrinsic nature, svabhava. The claim that all things are empty first appears in the Buddhist tradition in the early Mahayana Sutras, known collectively as Prajnaparamita, beginning roughly in the first century BCE. Earlier Buddhist thought was built around a more specific claim that the person is empty, that there is no separately existing enduring self, and that the person is a conceptual construction. Realization of the emptiness of the person was thought to be crucial to liberation from samsara. The earliest Mahayana texts go considerably beyond this claim, asserting that not just the person, but everything is devoid of intrinsic nature. So basically, Nagarjuna in this text makes the philosophical argument for this, because the sutras just say that it is thus. And he makes the philosophical argument. So then there are quite a few more Indian ancestors, and then we get to Bodhidharma or Bodhidharma. So Bodhidharma was an Indian, or we think, and he traveled to China to bring Buddhism there. So both Nagarjuna and Bodhidharma, if you end up studying anything about Chinese culture, they both have, it's not just Zen Buddhism or even Buddhism that they appear in. They're also, like, Bodhidharma is associated with a martial art, and there's lots of lore and mythology about Bodhidharma appearing, and then after he died, he was encountered a couple years later, and he was something like barefoot, and he had one sandal on a stick, and then they went and looked in his grave, and there was only a sandal in his grave. And so anyway, there's colorful mythologies around both of these characters. So Bodhidharma is said to have traveled from India to China to bring the Dharma at his teacher's request around 475 CE. And Buddhism had already been established in China for hundreds of years. There were thousands of temples, and the practice of meditation was widespread. So one of the, Bodhidharma pictures, there's many different koan collections. One of them is the Book of Serenity, which I'm gonna quote from, in which Bodhidharma appears, particularly his interaction with the Emperor of China shortly after Bodhidharma arrives. So Emperor Wu of Liang asked great teacher Bodhidharma, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" Bodhidharma said, "Empty. There's no holy." The emperor said, "Who are you facing me?" Bodhidharma said, "Don't know." The emperor didn't understand. Bodhidharma subsequently crossed the Yangtze River, supposedly on a reed, came to Shaolin and faced a wall for 9 years. So, you know, there's many different Dharma talks on this koan, and, you know, basically, it's not the case that Bodhidharma answered the emperor, "I don't know." Like, he was a fully transmitted teacher. He's getting at something else. Any case, then the idea was that Bodhidharma just kind of went off and focused on meditation and not on trying to attract students. So in the Denkaroku, the next ancestor, Taisho Eka, in his story, it says that he really wanted to study with Bodhidharma. He wanted to study with him so much, but Bodhidharma said no, and he just sat there. And so Taisho Eka stood out in the snow for days, and then finally he took a sword and cut off one of his arms. And then Bodhidharma was like, okay. So, you know, there's also, this is mythology as well. There's discussions about what this means and doesn't mean, but just to let you know a little bit about that mythology. But again, there's the mythological aspects, and then there's the more, more historical aspects. So this is from a little book called Zen Teachings of Bodhidharma, translated by Red Pine, because there's a few little short texts which are attributed to Bodhidharma. So in the intro, Red Pine talks a little bit about a few little facts that we know, not a whole lot about Bodhidharma. So he said, if this is all we know about Bodhidharma, why then is he the most famous of all the millions of monks who have studied and taught the Dharma in China? The reason is that he alone is credited with bringing Zen to China. Of course, Zen as meditation had been taught and practiced for several hundred years before Bodhidharma arrived. And much of what he said concerning doctrine had been said before. But Bodhidharma's approach to Zen was unique. As he says in these sermons, in this book, seeing your nature is Zen. Not thinking about anything is Zen. Everything you do is Zen. While others viewed Zen as purification of the mind or as a stage on the way to Buddhahood, Bodhidharma equated Zen with Buddhahood and Buddhahood with the mind, the everyday mind. Instead of telling his disciples to purify their minds, he pointed them to rock walls, to the movements of tigers and cranes, to a hollow reed floating across the Yangtze, to a single sandal. Bodhidharma Zen was Mahayana Zen, not Hinayana Zen, the sword of wisdom, not the meditation cushion. So that's why we have quotes on Bodhidharma's name. So moving right along, then we get to Daikan Enno, or in Chinese, Hui Neng. So he's known as the sixth ancestor. And his story, and I didn't have a chance to check this, but I think this is one of the first autobiographical texts that we know of. This is the Platform Sutra. And he tells his story in it. So he says, my father, a native of Fanyang, was dismissed from his official post and banished to be a commoner in Sinchu in Kwangtung. I was unlucky in that my father died when I was very young, leaving my mother poor and miserable. We moved to Kwangchu and were then in very, very bad circumstances. I was selling firewood in the market one day when one of my customers ordered some to be brought to his shop. Upon delivery being made and payment received, I left the shop, outside of which I heard a man reciting a sutra. As soon as I heard the text of this sutra, my mind at once became enlightened. Thereupon I asked the man the name of the book he was reciting, and was told it was the Diamond Sutra. I further inquired whence he came and why he recited this particular sutra. So then this guy explains that, you know, well, I heard it at this monastery. And so Huineng decides, he arranges it, he manages to arrange everything, and he goes off to explore more, goes off to the monastery. I then went to pay homage to the patriarch, the previous teacher, and was asked where I came from and what I expected to get from him. I replied, I am a commoner from Sinchu of Kwangtung. I have traveled far to pay you respect, and I ask for nothing but Buddhahood. You are a native of Kwangtung, a barbarian? How can you expect to be a Buddha? I replied, although there are northern men and southern men, north and south make no difference to their Buddha nature. A barbarian is different from your holiness physically, but there is no difference in our Buddha nature. So at this point, the teacher, Hongzhen, sends Huineng off, because at this point, this Huineng is illiterate, he's a layperson, and he's, you know, clearly pre-realized, so the abbot just sends him off to work in the rice hut for months. And then, not that, you know, like 9 months later or so, the Hongzhen wanted to name a Dharma heir. So he said, all of my students, you know, compose a poem to illustrate your understanding. And there was a senior student, Sen Shui, who everybody figured he was the obvious Dharma heir, so nobody else was going to submit a poem. And it's really sweet. In the Platform Sutra, it actually talks about Sen Shui, like, he's kind of insecure. He's like, I don't think I really have the understanding yet, but everybody's expecting me to write a poem. So he does, and he posts it, and then Hongzhen, just between him and Shen Shui, he's like, not really. But the abbot tells everybody else, oh, wow, what a great poem, and, you know, you should all memorize it and recite it. So that's how Huineng ends up hearing this enlightenment poem, because there's something, you know, there's people going around reciting it. So Huineng asks about it, and then, you know, Huineng's illiterate, so then he asks this boy to, he said, well, you know, would you mind if I write a poem? And then the boy wrote it on the wall for him. And let's see, the first poem, the Shen Shui's best, you know, effort. It's probably the end of the batteries. That's all right. I'll try to speak up. Let's see. So the first poem is, our body is the Bodhi tree, the enlightenment tree, and our mind a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour and let no dust alight. So this is the understanding of, you know, we practice and we're trying to, you know, return our mind to the present. And, you know, there's a point of our practice, which is, it's very effort driven. So then Hui Nung's poem, there is no Bodhi tree, nor stand of mirror bright, since all is void, where can the dust alight? So at first people are looking at this poem and they're like, wow. But then the abbot comes by and he's like, ah, that's clearly that person isn't enlightened. So they blow it off. But then the patriarch calls Hui Nung to his room and says, basically, you know, you're going to get my robe and bowl is the sign of the Dharma transmission. But he said, I can't transmit you. I mean, everybody will be totally mad. So I'm going to have to transmit you in secret and then you're going to have to take off. So Hui Nung receives the robe and bowl and then he takes off. And then he's pursued by hundreds of men. And then at some point there's this story of like the guy who's the most persistent in, let me see, in chasing him. Among them was a monk named Hui Ming, whose lay surname was Chen. He was a general of the fourth rank in lay life. His manner was rough and his temper hot. Of all the pursuers, he was the most vigilant in search of me. When he was about to overtake me, I threw the robe and the begging bowl on a rock, saying, "This robe is nothing but a symbol. What is the use of taking it away by force?" And then I hid. When he got to the rock, he tried to pick them up, but found he could not. Then he shouted, lay brother, I come for the Dharma, not for the robe." So eventually, Hui Nung gets to come out of hiding and becomes a teacher and is in our lineage. So, the deeper point of this whole exchange is something that Zen really wanted to emphasize for sincere reasons, but also to differentiate it from other sects, which was that the essence of what we are trying to learn, trying to awaken to, trying to pass on, is something outside of the scriptures. It's outside of knowledge. It's not about your status or whether you're ordained or how long you've spent in training. It's something else. Because if you figure, here's Hui Nung, he had never studied Buddhism, he was not ordained, he'd never heard the Diamond Sutra before, and he just got it. So then raises the question, you know, if it's not just a matter of learning all this stuff, what did he awaken to? All right, so then, moving right along, the next teacher is Tozan Ryokai, or Dongshan Liangjie. And he is, his dates, now we're starting to actually have dates, 807 to 869. And he wrote the Precious Mirror Samadhi, which is one of the poems that we chant regularly in service. So that's also in your chanting book. And one of the teachings contained in that poem, and that he also talked about elsewhere, is the teaching of the five, sometimes called the five ranks, but five Dharma positions, five different relationships between absolute and relative. So it's a very, very fascinating teaching, which I won't go into now. But also, Dongshan is honored as being the founder of the Chaodong school of Zen, which is what became Soto. So Soto is the Japanese way of saying that, and Chaodong is the Chinese or Chan way of saying it. And apparently it says at age 52, so he'd practiced a long time in other mainstream monasteries and then, you know, had enough cachet and freedom to go establish his own school. And he had lots of disciples. And the Chaodong school became regarded as one of what they call the five houses of Zen. And one of those is Linji, one of them is Rinzai Zen. But as it pointed out, all of these schools of Zen were very close to one another. And so frequently students went from one teacher to another. So there was a lot of cross-pollinization and mutual influence. But one of the things I was reading said, some descendants of Dongshan much later argued that the koan, which developed over centuries based on dialogues, there was a way that this was used in the Rinzai school in a very very formal way, that they took issue with that because it implied a dualistic distinction between ignorance and enlightenment. And instead, such Dongshan lineage descendants as Hongzhi encouraged the use of silent illumination as a way to take a self-fulfilling rather than a competitive path to enlightenment. So it wasn't even around Dongshan's time, but kind of later, that the evolution of these schools ended up both of them kind of self-identifying in contrast to one another. So the next name is Tendo Nyojo, who don't know that much about, and I'm not going to say a lot about, except that he was Dogen's teacher. So there's two names in a row here. So Eihei Dogen was a Japanese monk that he was ordained in the Tendai tradition, but he traveled to China to find what he felt was, you know, truer Dharma. And his years are 1200 to 1253. And so he had studied, once he went to China, he studied in a bunch of different places using koans and whatever. But then he really, you know, had a meeting with Tendo Nyojo, or Rujing, when he heard Rujing say something about casting off body and mind. So then Dogen brought this Chaodong, this Soto tradition, back to Japan, and we think of him as the founder of, you might as well say founder of Soto Zen, right? Because Soto's the Japanese way of pronouncing it. And he established Eihei-ji Temple, which still exists today. And the particular form of Soto monasticism, and was a prolific writer. So we've studied his teachings many times, recite some of them. And there are quite a few books on him if you are interested. So a few names later is Keizan, who, again, I don't know all that much about either, but I do know that we say, this is a passage from, this is a little book by Keido Chisan, who's actually the second to the last name in the lineage, written about 1960. And he says, in religions, on the one hand, we must go forward, ever deepening our religious experiences, while on the other hand, recognizing our mission to guide other people to the depths of our own experience. We must enable them to know the joy that comes from the knowledge of the Dharma and the bliss that comes from the practice of meditation. It is absolutely essential to have a personal character like that of Great Master Keizan in order to carry out this mission. To regard all people with warm affection, to become the friend of the common people, to enter the realm of the ideal together with them and share one's joy with others. These are the characteristics of the true man of religion. The Soto school believes that it is able to fulfill its basic mission because of the stern, father-like character of Dogen and the compassionate, mother-like character of Keizan. So Keizan did all kinds of interesting things that ended up, I mean, some of it was just the political situation of the time, but it ended up really popularizing Soto Zen much, you know. Dogen, you know, set this, you know, had these austere philosophies and this strict monastic practice, and Keizan, as I I would like, I should study and know more. More ceremony, more accessible things for, this is how Soto Zen became one of the most widespread forms of Buddhism in Japan and was known as farmer's Zen. So the Rinzai was often known as samurai Zen and Soto Zen was farmer's Zen. So there's a whole richness to that, right? I think in that Soto Zen in medieval Japan, if you're curious about it. So Keizan's honored as the second patriarch of Soto Zen. And he also really championed the practice of women. So he helped to establish a number of monasteries for women as well. And let's see, like I said, it's like, we're not doing anybody justice here, but Manzan Dohaku is the next name. And that's a very interesting one. Manzan, his dates are 1635 to 1715. And that one of my Dharma brothers wrote, it can be argued that after Dogen, Keizan, and possibly Gassan, Manzan probably had a greater influence on the development of Soto Zen than anyone else through its history in Japan. And this had to do with the tradition of Dharma transmission. So as I had described it earlier, this kind of intimate teacher-student apprenticeship relationship was the ideal, if you will. But through all of this, especially once Buddhism gets to China and then Japan, you have to remember all of this is tied up with politics and power and money, and you know, there's always this tension between maintaining an austere, pure tradition, but then you have no support. And, you know, it's not purely secular governments either, right? You rely on the government's goodwill, you rely on government support to survive. So one of the things that had happened in Japan was that here there'd be temples that would have resources. They would have a history and resources and, you know, buildings. And when it came time to find a new abbot, a new leader of that temple, somebody would be chosen to do that. And then it was decided that then you instantly became, you joined that lineage. So kind of erased what your previous, you know, Dharma transmission or teacher-student relationships were, and you were just kind of artificially made of, you know, received Dharma transmission in that lineage. So it took away that kind of authentic aspect to it and tied it to these temples, which had several different repercussions. One, it begins to muddy up that whole tradition of trying to make sure that we're actually passing the you know, transmission on properly. Not that that's infallible, but it's something. But also then smaller lineages started to die out because, you know, you'd be like, you'd have a good teacher over here, but they got a small temple and they get a couple Dharma heirs and then they get, you know, promoted up to be abbot of this fancy temple. And now they're like part of a different Dharma lineage. So anyway, Manzan patiently, he was really good, really wise politically, and he patiently worked for about 40 years to reform the Dharma transmission thing. And then at the end of his life, he ended up actually appealing to the secular authorities to change things because the ecclesiastical courts were all too invested in the way things were. So he finally appealed to the secular authorities and did a lot of quoting of Dogen about Dharma transmission and authentic lineage. So that was changed. So let's see. So I will only briefly speak about, because, you know, it's pretty recent history, but Kato Chisan was a Japanese monk. So he ended up serving as the abbot of Sojiji. There's two head temples of Soto Zen in Japan, Eiheiji, which Dogen founded, and Sojiji, which Keizan founded. And So Kato Chisan was, and Soju is actually bigger and in a city. And Kato Chisan, so it's a real honor, you know, that he served as abbot there for a while. And he was on a teaching tour in 1960 and invited Peggy Kennett to come study with him at Soju-ji in Japan, which frankly is really weird. I mean, there's no, at that time, and probably even really today, there are no Westerners at that monastery. And there were no women at that monastery. I mean, the women were, you know, there has been traditions, but the women are like, they're way down the alley. So it was very interesting, but you know, I mean, she's like a bold Western woman, and so she comes, she goes to Japan. And I will show this to the Zoom folks and then pass this around the room. This is a, oh, let's see, it's not very, it's a little too close. I think there's a, if anybody can look on the website on our lineage page, I think this, you might be able to share that image of our story of our lineage. But I can pass this around. It's kind of a sweet picture of Kato Chisan, just this, like this sweet, friendly, cherubic face. And then here's this crazy English lady that, you know, she actually wanted to be a priest in the Church of England, but that wasn't allowed. And she was an organist, and, you know, the beautiful offertory that we had today during Vesak, she wrote. So she's a very interesting character. Anyway, she did her training at Soju-ji, which she describes in an autobiographical book called The Wild White Goose, which is a little bit like semi-mythological as well, as I understand it, but it's interesting. It's an interesting read. And she had a really hard time. I mean, if you are a young Japanese healthy monk, you have a hard time in this kind of training. And if you are a, she had health problems. she had a really rough time, but she made it through. And apparently, so this is from an interview with her in a book. It's a lot of interviews of Western women Buddhist teachers. Let's see. She says, so she went through the whole, there it is. She went through the whole process of training. So it's very formalized in Japan. You do this, and then you do this, and then you're empowered to do this, and then you have this ceremony, and whatever. And she ended up, Zuisei is the kind of the culminating ceremony when you, and I haven't done it, many Western priests haven't done it, you go to Soju-ji or Eheji, oh, let's see, is this one, the Soto Zen, is just called Soto Zen, an introduction to the thought of serene reflection meditation. Roshi Kennett's Zuisei ceremony was conducted in public, which had never, a woman's Zuisei ceremony had never been done in public. It was just done in private. So the way that I heard it described was that, I guess, Kato Chisan saw potential in Roshi Kennett for her own awakening and to be a teacher, but he also kind of used her as like a ramrod to force through opportunities for Japanese women priests, because in a way it's easier to just blatantly disregard when it's a foreigner than to try to do it with a Japanese woman. So she did this public Zuisei ceremony. She said, "I have never done a ceremony with more terror inside me than that one, with 12 men down each side, each one with curtains drawn as if to say, 'I'm not here.' Those were the witnesses. Try that sometime. That can be pretty scary. In a foreign country, in a language you're not 100% sure of, with a lot of people who are hating your guts. And the reason Koho Zenji did it, and I've got it on tape, was for the benefit of the women in his country." So I I will leave it there because we're out of time. And Roshi Kennett is a story unto herself. She was a very brilliant but also controversial teacher. Unlike many male teachers, she didn't have sexual improprieties, but there were other power issues. Yeah, there you go. I would have loved to leave some time for questions and discussion, but like pretty good for an over 2,500 year overview in less than an hour.
Can I have one quick question?
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
Who was the translator on your copy of the Platform Sutra?
Okay, so the Platform Sutra is translated by Price and Moolam. It's a Shambhala Classics version. Okay. Any last minute questions? We have a couple minutes. Oh, Marv.
Excuse me. Just three short tidbits that are debatable. Two about women. I heard a podcast this morning that said that the 27th ancestor, Bodhidharma's teacher, was a woman. And the same podcast said that Dogen established a nunnery section at Aheji, but it died out a few centuries later. Mm. And the third tidbit is about the Platform Sutra. An earlier version found at Dun Wang has a third poem, which links the other two, completing the triad. It's very short. Mike, I'll read it.
Oh, yeah. You got it?
I got it.
All right. Go ahead.
This is Red Pine's translation. The mind is the Bodhi tree. The body is the mirror stand. The mirror itself is so clean, dust has no place to land.
Nice. Nice. Yes, because ordinarily we're not just relative and absolute, right? We're like, we're trying to be non-dual about it. Sweet. Yeah, I'd heard that about the like women's. But it's like, I mean, you're talking about like, you know, that shed down by the stream. That's where their monastery was. But yeah, there, I mean, and there's always been that presence of the women nearby, which I just find so amazingly admirable that, you know, the women weren't going to have power, or they weren't going to become abbots of big monasteries or have fame or anything, but they were always there nearby. Practicing. Any last? All right, well, hopefully you found this interesting. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was very nice.